Good evening. This is Life Rattle, your story show, and I'm your host, Virginia Ashbery. Tonight, Life Rattle number 1285 features two stories by Juan Alas. Juan Alas lives in Toronto with his family, where he works as a flexographic printer. Alas was born in 1954 in a small remote village in northern El Salvador, near the Honduran border. The family lived off the land like the rest of the country people in El Salvador. The village of Las Huertas, where Juan Alas grew up, was one of the poorest in the region. In the first story tonight, Alas shows us the undercurrent of violence and terror creeping into the daily lives of the Salvadorian people after civil war erupted in 1980. Let's listen now as Guy Allen reads My Brother's Death, written by Juan Alas. And you're listening to Life Rattle, produced from Toronto, Ontario, Canada. And please be warned, some of the imagery you will hear in tonight's story is quite violent.
My Brother's Death by Juan Alas. 41 kilometers north of the capital city of San Salvador, and about 150 meters east off the northern highway, stood one of the biggest and most attractive houses in the village of Potrero Grande. The house was fairly new, built in 1973 from mud bricks and baked mud shingles. The front corridor facing the north side had been enclosed as an extension to be used for a small grocery store. There was a big corridor on the back of the house on the south side. The east side had a single carport. The whole house, including the carport, was decorated with red cement floor tiles. Cement tiles are popular in El Salvador. Big wooden shutters, suspended from hooks, opened so that shoppers could receive their groceries and pay for them. On the front patio facing the dead-end street, an almendras tree spread its shade. Almendra trees, tropical ornamental trees, grow straight and tall. Their branches grow at even levels and grow sideways. As they spread around, each set of branches forms a perfect circle and separates from the next set by about 4 or 5 feet. Almendra fruit has the form of a beef patty, but smaller. The fruit is edible but not sold commercially. It is green and turns yellowish when ripe. This tree provided shade to the shoppers and helped to keep the house cool. In the back of the house on the patio, a lemon tree spread its shade. It also provided the family with lemons year-round. Its branches had grown big enough to join the edge of the roof. Next to the lemon tree, a well about 25 to 30 feet deep supplied enough water for the house and part of the neighborhood. A few meters from the well and next to the west end of the house stood a marañón or cashew tree. Next to the marañón tree, looking south, stood a big mango tree. It spread part of its branches over to the next lot. The family could reach mangoes from the ground without effort. They tasted sweet and creamy. On the east side and next to the carport stood a lime tree. Another marañón tree spread its branches over the lime tree. Guava, bananas, and other kinds of fruits spread throughout the backyard. A shiny red Toyota pickup truck was usually parked in the carport, except when its owner was out. The red Toyota served as the ambulance for the community. Every time there was an emergency, day or night, people came hoping the red Toyota was there so their loved ones could be rushed to the nearest hospital. In the absence of government services in El Salvador, good Samaritans were the only source of help for the citizens. My brother Santiago guided us all in certain ways. He enjoyed popularity and some modest fame. For us, his brothers and sister, he was a legend. For my father, he was the model son he wished for. Second born in a family of nine, Santiago knew hunger. When he was 13, he left the family with a friend in search of a job. He found seasonal work harvesting rice. When the season ended, he returned home to my father and mother. Soon after, he went back. His search for a better life was not over and wasn't going to be for a while. He finally found a job as a gardener in the gardens of the Santa Barbara Ranch in the Limpa Valley. Sometime later, he was promoted to do part of the cleaning inside the ranch house. Years later, he became the administrator at another ranch. Then he became independent in the early 1970s. His glory didn't last long. Although he was well known by many people, that didn't prevent his death. When the Civil War began in 1980, my wife Paula was pregnant. She was due in the middle of May. There were two hospitals where she could have the baby, one in San Salvador and one in Chalatenango. The distance to both places was about the same. On the morning of May 19th, I left to work against my wife's plea to stay home. While I was out, Santiago rushed my wife to the hospital in Chalatenango in his red Toyota pickup. When I returned home in the evening, my brother told me the story. Because he couldn't stay, the baby hadn't been born when he left the hospital. Next day, Tuesday, was Visitor's Day. I went early in the morning by bus to see my wife and my baby, a beautiful, healthy girl. We named her Anna Maria. I came back from the hospital around 4:30 in the afternoon. My house was just behind my brother's backyard, on another dead-end street. I had to pass in front of my brother's store before reaching my place. I walked straight to his open window. I wanted to tell him how happy I was. He stood leaning against the window. "How is Paula?" he said as soon as I came close. "Is she okay?" "She had a cesarean," I said. "But is she fine now?" "Yes," I said. "How about the baby? Is it a boy or a girl?" "It's a girl," I said. "Her name is Anna Maria." "That is a beautiful name," he said. "When are they coming home?" "It'll take at least a week before Paula can come home," I answered. "Now you have to work harder. You have two kids," Santiago said. "Well, go home and tell Dad the good news. He will like to know." My father had been blind for 20 years, but he kept track of everything. I was still talking to Santiago when my father heard my voice. He asked my sister Catalina if I was coming home. I crossed my brother's backyard and came home. "Is that you, Ramon?" he asked when he heard my steps. He called me by my middle name. "Yes, it is me," I answered. "How is Paula? Is she fine?" "Yes, Dad, she had a cesarean, but she is fine now," I answered. "The baby is a girl, Dad, and I named her Anna Maria, your favorite name." "You did? Wonderful," my father said. Visits in the hospital were scheduled 4 days a week, Sundays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Saturdays. Wednesday night, my brother Santiago asked if I was going to the hospital the next day. Thursday morning at 5:30, as usual, Santiago was singing his favorite songs from the 50s while he took a shower. Once he finished showering, he went to open the store, as usual. At about 8 o'clock, I crossed his backyard rather than going around on the street. "Are you going to the hospital now?" he asked. "Yes, I am going now," I answered. "Good. You must go," he said. I went to the hospital and spent most of the day there. When I came back at about 4:30 in the afternoon, my brother wasn't in the store. His red Toyota wasn't parked in the carport either. Well, that was no surprise. Maybe he had gone to Ahuilares, the nearest city, I said to myself. Before I walked into his house, Roberto, Santiago's second child, called me. "Uncle, my father went to Ahuilares to pick up some fertilizer and got kidnapped by National Guardsmen," he said in tears. "What are you talking about?" I said. "Yes, he left about 1.5 hours ago and hasn't come back. Raul Cornejo just came from Ahuilares and told me," my nephew said. I took a second set of car keys and went by bus to Ahuilares in search of for him. His red Toyota was parked in front of our cousin's pharmacy, Farmacia San Jose. I asked a few people around. They confirmed my brother Santiago had been taken away while he was making a phone call from a public phone outside City Hall. The kidnappers were dressed in plain clothes, but everyone knew them. They were National Guardsmen. They were armed with G3 semi-automatic rifles and machine guns. The G3 rifle was the official National Guard gun. They took Santiago straight to the National Guard headquarters in Ahuilares. I was going to go to headquarters to ask for him, but people advised me not to. It was too dangerous. If I did, they would probably have killed me too. I drove the red Toyota pickup back home, had something to eat, and took off for San Salvador. Another cousin was a well-known lawyer and lived in San Salvador. Maybe he could do something. I called him, but he wasn't much of a help. "The situation is too difficult. I can do nothing," he said. He was frightened. Next morning, my search started. Santiago's wife, Delfina, came with me. We hoped he was still alive. We went to police stations, morgues, places where a body or bodies had been discovered. We had no luck. At the end of the day, we felt tired, frustrated, and confused. We hardly ate anything. We were not hungry anyway. Saturday came. Our search continued. We were losing hope, but we didn't stop. We looked mostly by roadsides. That's where the National Police, the Treasury Police, the National Guard, and the Army dumped bodies after they tortured and killed people. In the afternoon, someone said that a group of men were just burying an unknown body a few kilometers from where we were. We took off as fast as we could. We were lucky. We got to the place before the compassionate group of men left. They had just finished burying the body. I pulled onto the shoulder of the road, stepped out of the pickup, and gave the men a detailed description of Santiago. The logo on his T-shirt, the white metal bracelet on his electronic watch, his gold wedding ring, his gold chain with the Star of David. A small man, about 5'3" tall, black straight hair, husky and dark-skinned, stood face to face with me, listening attentively, his mouth halfway open and his eyes looking straight into mine. "He is the one we just buried. You want us to unbury him? Please, we'll pay you," my sister-in-law and I replied simultaneously. "We'll do it," the good man said. Delfina and I got into the pickup and drove home. Our news to our family was a mixture of good and bad. Good because we had found him. Bad because he was dead. We went to Ahuilares to buy a casket. Then we went back to the place where Santiago had been buried. There he was, my brother, wrapped in a piece of clear plastic, eyes closed, face pale, and sad. He had been strangled to death. His throat was swollen and purple. He had rope marks indicating he had been hanged. His ribs were burned, and his skin was peeling off. He was burned as part of his torture, probably with a propane torch. His wrists had rope marks as well. His hands were kept tied while he was tortured. He had probably been beaten and tortured for a few hours. His watch, chain, wedding ring, and wallet were missing. The men who buried him didn't steal them. His killers had. I wanted to cry. I wanted to scream. Most of all, I wanted revenge. I was angry. My brother didn't deserve that kind of death. Nobody does. We took the body home. Family and friends gathered in my brother's house and waited for our arrival. My sister-in-law cried all the way home. I cried on and off while I was driving. My father? How am I going to face my father, I thought. even though he already knows. He is widowed, blind, in fragile health, and his beloved son is dead. Oh, God help me. Saturday was visitor's day in a hospital. Paula was ready to come home. My aunt, Maria, and my other brother, Alfonso, went to visit my wife. They knew what was going on. Paula asked why I wasn't there. They told her I had to work, but she suspected something else. When they got off the bus and walked from the highway down the path to the house, Paula was surprised to see so many people in my brother's house. Perhaps she thought I had had an accident or something. Nobody dared tell her. She demanded an explanation. Finally, my sister Catalina told her. Paula was still in pain from her cesarean. She could hardly stand on her own. Now she fainted. She too had looked up to Santiago. And now Santiago was dead.
That was My Brother's Death by Juan Alas. The next story takes us with the Alas family as they flee into Belize as refugees. Let's listen now as Guy Allen reads Belize by Juan Alas.
Belize by Juan Alas. The civil war in El Salvador had just begun with the new year, 1980. In the first few months of the year, members of the National Guard killed some of my cousins. On May 22nd, four National Guardsmen dressed in plain clothes and heavily armed kidnapped, tortured, and strangled my older brother, Santiago. On May 24th, I found Santiago's body thrown by the side of a road. My brother's death scared me. I wanted to leave the country as soon as possible. I knew I risked my life if I stayed. Soon after Santiago's death, I started preparing to leave. It took me 3 months to get my documents ready and to decide where to go. Before leaving El Salvador, I advised my family not to reveal my destination. On August 18th, I left the country with my wife and our two children. We left behind my father, my uncle, and his wife, a brother, and three sisters. Most people thought I went to Costa Rica, but we took refuge in Unitedville, district of El Cayo, Belize. We carried only a few belongings and little money. We looked for a peaceful place where we could live and work free from fear. Belize, what used to be known as British Honduras, became an independent country on September the 21st, 1981. Belize occupies about 21,000 square kilometers in the Caribbean basin south of the Yucatan Peninsula. Except for a small percentage of Mayan Indians, the population of Belize was mostly black, tracing ancestors to Jamaica. Before the arrival of refugees from the rest of Central America, Belize had a population of about 150,000 people. Since we spoke only Spanish, language became our first barrier in Belize. Although the majority of the population spoke Creole, the official language of Belize was English. Along with the language barrier, we faced the obstacles of being white and being refugees. Since Belize had been isolated from the rest of Central America for a long time, Belizeans took a long while to accept the flow of refugees when conflicts started in neighboring countries. Like anywhere else, it became a political issue. One party defended refugees while the other party attacked them. A month after our arrival in Belize, our money ran out. I had not found a job yet. We faced hunger. Our children had coconut milk for 3 days as their only source of food. Jobs were scarce in Belize. The few available ones were for Belizeans, not for refugees. We, Salvadorians and Guatemalans, faced more discrimination than anyone else, perhaps because we constituted the two main groups of refugees. Rumors of refugees being killed in the northern part of the country circulated, scaring and confusing me. We had no place to go. I received letters from El Salvador advising me to be careful because the killers of my brother, Santiago, wanted to find me. They started gathering information of my refuge from a family living in Belmopan, the Belizean capital. The family came from the same village in El Salvador. When we arrived in Belize, they knew our residence in Unitedville, came to visit us a few times, and wrote back to El Salvador giving our address. I had not used my name when corresponding to El Salvador. Since my wife is from a different province and no one knew her maiden name, I used her name. But our friends in Belmopan had blown our secret. It takes a lot of courage to move to a country where nobody waits for you. After our arrival in Unitedville, I tried to establish relations with my neighbors. Next door to us lived the Justice of the Peace for Unitedville, Mr. Gilbert. Mr. Gilbert, about 60 years old, became my first friend in the neighborhood. A real gentleman and caring person, Mr. Gilbert welcomed and helped us. He spoke a little bit of Spanish, enough to communicate. In his broken Spanish, Mr. Gilbert translated for us a few times when villagers wanted to communicate. As Justice of the Peace, in charge of the public phone, and post office administrator for the village, Mr. Gilbert knew all the villagers. He introduced us to a few neighbors. John and his wife, an older couple, became very close to us. Together with Mr. Gilbert and family, they offered us their support. Mr. Gilbert also introduced us to Mr. Moss, a tall, black, skinny man, probably in his 80s, another elder in the village, perhaps the eldest around. Known as the sorcerer, Mr. Moss knew everybody in the village and the villages around. Mr. Moss became a friend to us as well. Mr. Moss owned the house where we lived, a small hut at the bottom of a hill. It stood about 4 feet off the ground, suspended by big round pillars and made of scrap wood with tin sheet on its roof. Surrounded by coconut, orange, mango, and avocado trees, the little hut, about 100 feet off the main road, provided shelter to us for 7 months. Mr. Moss knew and understood our situation. As I walked by in front of his house one day, I saw Mr. Moss standing at his front door. He called me in and asked, "Are you still looking for a job?" "Yes, yes indeed. A big man is coming this afternoon. He is looking for someone to clear a farm he just bought. Would you do that?" "Sure I would," I replied. "If I talk to him about you, he will hire you for sure." "Would you do that for me?" "Certainly. Come back at about 1 o'clock this afternoon. The big man will be around at that time," Mr. Moss said. I needed the job. I went back at 1 o'clock. A new white 4x4 Cherokee rested in the shadows of a mango tree beside Mr. Moss' house. A black man wearing a police hat sat behind the wheel. Another black man, tall and husky, talked to Mr. Moss while he stood in front of Mr. Moss' front door. As I came, Mr. Moss called me in and introduced me to his guest, the big man, the Belizean Police and Immigration Director, Mr. Willoughby. Mr. Willoughby hired me to work on his farm for 10 Belizean dollars a day, $5 U.S. I had a job. I had also secured my working permit in Belize, hassle-free. I knew a hard task waited for me. I hadn't worked with the machete since my adolescent years, when I helped my father in the fields planting corn, rice, beans, and vegetables. Monday morning at 7 o'clock, I walked to Mr. Willoughby's farm, a house off the main road with about 10 to 15 acres of land, covered with dense, thorny bushes. Mr. Willoughby's property ran down a hill to a deep, mighty river. I had soft skin. A big blister developed on my right hand and peeled off before noon. Soon after, my arms and my left hand started to bleed. Thorns scratched me. Anguish and frustration reigned in my mind. My inner voice kept telling me, "Quit, go home and tell your wife this is too hard for you." I sat down to eat my lunch under a small tree. Its shadow protected me from the burning sun while I ate cold rice, beans, and tortillas my wife had packed for me. While eating, I had time to reconsider my thoughts. I never quit anything before. While questioning myself, my wife and my children came to mind. They depend on me. How can I quit now? For my own pride and for the love of my family, I am not quitting, no matter how bad it hurts. I returned home at 5 o'clock in the afternoon. Dried blood on my arms and left hand showed the kind of work I had done. My right hand still bled from the blister that peeled off, leaving my flesh unprotected. My son ran to greet me as he usually did. Together we went to see my daughter, whom he had to watch while my wife washed clothes. I wanted to hold my daughter in my arms, but I couldn't. I had dried blood all over. "What happened?" my wife asked when she came in and saw my hands. "Not much," I said. "Did you cut yourself?" "No, my skin peeled off while I worked, and my arms and left hand just bled from scratches." "I will clean it and wrap it for you," my wife said. That night she cleaned and wrapped my hand with a soft piece of cloth, since we had no bandages. Since my arrival in Belize, it had become my custom to take a dip every morning in the chilly waters of a creek that ran south of Unitedville. I made no exception on Tuesday morning, my second day of work. As dawn broke the darkness of the night, I went to the creek before going to work. Swimming in the cold waters of the creek didn't relieve the pain in my hand. It hurt even more. Before I went, my wife wrapped my hand again as gently as she could. Her concern for my well-being almost convinced me to stay home. I wanted to stay home, but I had to go, and I went. By 9 o'clock, the white piece of cloth my wife so gently wrapped my hand with had changed to blood-soaked red. The pain I felt was worse than the day before. Again, I wanted to quit. I struggled with the weakest side of myself. I bled every day for 3 weeks before my skin got thick enough. I worked in the fields every day. It took time before I became a master with the machete. Seeing blood pouring from my hand and arms didn't scare me anymore. I had scratches on my face and on my arms. Those thorny bushes that terrorized me in the beginning became part of my daily life. My children and my wife saw me in pain day after day. Until we immigrated to the United States in March 1981, I cut bushes every day, not only in Mr. Willoughby's farm, but in other places too. That was the only job I could find in Belize.
That was Belize by Juan Alas. And that concludes Life Rattle number 1285. Guy Allen read and recorded these two stories written by Juan Alas. My name is Virginia Ashbery. Life Rattle returns next week with more stories. Life Rattle is produced in Toronto and was created by Guy Allen and Arnie Ackman.